going to happen here. Something's happening. But it's a good story in and of itself. Now, Naomi had a relative on her husband's side, a man of standing from the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor." Naomi said to her, "Go ahead, my daughter." So she went out, entered a field, and began to glean behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Just then, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. "The Lord be with you." "The Lord bless you," they answered. Boaz asked the overseer of his harvesters, "Who does that young woman belong to?" The overseer replied, "She's the Moabite who came back from Moab with Naomi. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters.' She came into the field and has remained here from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter." So Boaz said to Ruth, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field, and don't go away from here. Stay here with the women who work for me. Watch the field where the harvesters are working, and follow along after the women. I have told the men not to lay a hand on you. And whenever you are thirsty, go get a drink from the water jars the men have filled." At this, she bowed down with her face to the ground. She asked him, "Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" Boaz replied, "I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother in your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." And she answered, "May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord. You have reassured me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I do not have the standing of one of your servants." When she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her some roasted grain. She ate all she wanted, and she had some leftovers. As she got to glean, Boaz gave his orders to his men. "Let her gather among the sheaves and don't reprimand her. Even pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them there for her to pick up, and don't rebuke her." So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she threshed the barley she had gathered, and it amounted to about an ephah. She carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left, brought out her leftovers, right, after she had eaten enough. Her mother-in-law asked her, "Where exactly did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. "The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz," she says. "The Lord bless him," Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. "He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead." She added, "That man is our close relative. He is one of our family guardians." Then Ruth the Moabite said, "He even said to me, 'Stay with my workers until they finish harvesting all my grain.'" Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It will be good for you, my daughter, to go with the women who work for him, because in someone else's field you might be harmed." So Ruth stayed close to the women of Boaz to glean the barley and wheat harvest until the barley and wheat harvests were finished, and she lived with her mother-in-law. So that's a nice end to the story. For some of us, this visit to Israel 1,000 years before Christ was born, literally it's 1,000 years, I looked, almost on the head. It's a strange place. This story is full of allusions to history, people, background, practices, and customs that really don't mean anything to most of us, right? Now, if you were raised on a farm, you'll relate better to the story of Ruth, right, Jessica? You see, some of it rings, you know, oh, that's familiar. But many aspects of farming are still quite different. And so we all have to take a journey back in time and place. When Glenn and I decided to get married, he took me on a journey to visit his family. Now, I was from the greater Los Angeles area and very much part of the culture of the 60s. On the other hand, Glenn grew up on a farm in small town Minnesota in a family of 8 children. They missed the 60s altogether, I think. He didn't even like the Beatles, you know. You wonder how we ever got together. But I was ready for the farm. I was. I watched 13 piglets being born. I had huge urine-soaked rats running across my bare feet. I gathered eggs in the hen house. But the thing I was not ready for was the relationships in this small town. So there was a huge family. Another family had 10 children and 10 cousins, et cetera, et cetera. And a bunch of townspeople who knew each other's business and talked about it constantly and out loud when they were present. Well, one day we took a load of pigs to the butcher in town. When we got there, after the secretary had entered the pigs and everything in the ledger, she said to Glenn's father, "Oh, Lorraine called and she asked you to pick up chow mein noodles on the way home." Well, my eyebrows hit my hairline. I was not used to people in businesses even knowing who you are, let alone helping you out with your shopping list. And so giving you personal messages. And then as we were leaving, what happens? But the butcher came out. And from the back, he was huge. You know, have you ever seen like a butcher? I mean, really a butcher, they get these biceps like this. I mean, this is the old town, old fashioned butcher. And he's big with these biceps. And he has an apron on and big gloves. And he's covered with blood, right? His apron is blood soaked. And he's carrying a cleaver in his hand. I swear blood was dripping from the cleaver. Probably not, but that's how I remember it. And you know, and I'm like, well, if you know me, not I'm like, he doesn't scare me, you know. So I'm standing my ground, and he opens his mouth and says, "Hey, Robert, Lorraine wants you to pick up some chow mein noodles on the way home." And I just laughed. It was so weird. It was bizarre to me. Utterly bizarre to me, coming from an urban environment, to have this random butcher know your business and deliver personal messages from the wife. In a small town, especially in hard times, people have tight relationships. They help people out, and they all know who you are, and they all know your business, for better or for worse. And the story of Ruth understands God right there as part of it, intimately interested in those details and that little town, that little village. So that gives us a start on our story, which is primarily about two women, Naomi and Ruth. And like I said, chapter 2 is a story in and of itself. Today I want to make this live for you, and I want you to live in the story, because that's what you're supposed to do with these stories. As a review, in chapter 1, we see that Naomi, her husband, and her two sons had some very bad luck. It was a series of unfortunate events. First of all, they lived in Israel during the time of the judges. That was not Israel's finest hour. And the year 1000 was a terrible time for women. I don't know if you know this, but Ruth comes after the book of Judges, and the book of Judges ends with gang rape, and mass femicide of a whole tribe, not in that order, however. You would not be wrong to understand all these looming threats in chapter 2 in that context. Did you pick up the threats? How often there were threats, either implied or overt, against Ruth? And second of all, there was a famine in the land, which is truly life-threatening in third world cultures now, and even more so then. Did I say third? That was second. Third, they left the land, which is never good. You say, don't go, don't do it, you know. But it was a famine. It was life-threatening. So they became refugees and immigrants. Oh, a great theme for today. Refugees and immigrants. Fourth, the husband and sons died. And so now Naomi is in the worst possible position a woman can be in. She's a widow with no children, no sons, and no means of support. At the end of chapter 1, she's so depressed, she wants to change her name to Bitter. She believes that in light of these events, God has turned against her. She says so several times. Now, one of the positives of this is we see that Naomi thinks about life theologically. She says, where is God in this? End of chapter 1, say, obviously, I'm not a friend. He's not a friend, you know. Obviously, this is not going well for me. She has no hope. She has no future. However, her sons had married two women, and though they had no children, and that was bad, right? So what good are our daughters-in-law if they have no children? They're not going to take. They're really not a big help. Almost a burden. One of the daughters-in-law wants to stay with Naomi and be a family to her, even though she had her own family. Naomi must have been an amazing woman. She really must have been an amazing woman. So Naomi reluctantly takes Ruth back to Israel with her to this little provincial town called Bethlehem. Does that ring a bell? Well, it wasn't the Bethlehem of Jesus' day. This was a little back town at this time, tiny town. But Naomi's husband, Elimelech, was from the tribe of Judah. When Jacob blesses his son in Genesis 50, you know, Jacob's kind of the father of the 12 tribes of Israel and all that. At the end of the life, we're not going to get into the whole story. I'm just going to leave a little part of it. But the whole story lies behind this. At the end of Genesis, Jacob blesses his sons. Judah is the fourth son born to Leah among at least 13 children. And Jacob prophesies that he is the one who's going to be dominant. This is one of those backwards things that keeps happening in the Bible. He says, Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He crouches down. He stretches out like a lion, like a lioness. Who dares rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until a tribute comes to him, and the obedience of the peoples is his. Binding his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine, he washes his garments in wine and his robe in the blood of grapes. Well, a lot of agricultural stuff there that we could get into, but you get the idea that Judah's gonna rule. The descendants of Judah are going to be very, very important. They would rule the tribe or nation of Israel. Well, that would be David and his descendants. They're going to come from the tribe of Judah, from this line, from this inheritance. But also, the King of Kings, the son of David, the Christ would come from the tribe of Judah. So that's another thing about this culture. Actually, where you come from is a big deal. They just love genealogies, right? I mean, you recognize that. You obviously start, oh, I think I'll read the Bible. I'll read Matthew. And all of a sudden, you've got so-and-so begat so, if you're reading King James. So-and-so gave birth to so-and-so. He gave birth to so-and-so. And you wonder what that's about. Now we're learning some interesting things about DNA and about what it means to what our life is now. But back then, your ancestry determined who you were and what your place was. Your genealogy was like your passport, your medical records, and the history that defined you, all wrapped up into one thing. And having children, oh, that's all important. It keeps your name alive. It protects your inheritance. That's the land that God has given you, particularly important in Israel. We find out at the end of the book that we are actually meeting King David's grandmother and great-grandmother in this little story. And that's really profound. But the story is all about the little things. It's all about God being in the little details of everyday life that you can always relate to. I mean, we're talking about people who are struggling, not this great person on the throne. So God, though, is really invested in the tribe of Judah. He really is. And he wants to make sure they have babies, right? I mean, this is an ongoing thing. You'd think it wouldn't be so difficult, but it really already has been quite difficult to keep Judah alive, to keep that tribe going. Good stories about that besides this one. God is loyal to his people as a whole, you know, to bring about a king. And this is a wonderful book about how God put together King David's family and eventually gave them a king after God's own heart. But he's also loyal to the poor widow Naomi, who has lost everything. She was alone and destitute, and God comes through for her. But he does it in a very hidden way, at least as far as the story is concerned. He works behind the scenes through a series of fortunate events. They could have been considered coincidence or chance. You know, it just so happened. It just so happened. And, this is very tongue-in-cheek. You know, the storytellers kind of nudge, nudge, wink, wink, you know, that it didn't just so happen. None of this stuff just so happened. God works in the everyday affairs of life, not just dramatic miracles. So I like to see noticing what he's doing like this as God sightings. God sightings. And Naomi's actually really good at this. She's like an example of someone who has vision. She doesn't always get it right, but she sees him. What's interesting is that God works in some strange and wonderful ways through some key women to keep the line of Judah going and to contribute to the identity of David and Jesus. Remember, this is their identity is all going into the formation of their character and who they are and what they're going to do. So this is really, really important in the culture. Four women are mentioned in Jesus' genealogy in Matthew 1. Tamar. Oh, I so want to tell you that story, but I'm not. Rahab. Ruth, and Bathsheba. Now, Matthew doesn't name Bathsheba. He calls her Uriah's wife. And I think the reason for that is of the four, she's the one that's not a hero. The other three are total and complete heroes in the story of Israel. Some people call these women notorious because they did things that were not proper for a respectable woman to do. But you know what they say? Well-behaved women seldom make history. God clearly commends Tamar, Rahab, and Ruth. So, besides Naomi, what are these characters? You probably got from the reading Ruth's a Moabite. I hope you got from the reading that wasn't a great thing. That was a problem. Now, I'm glad I'm going to be speaking frankly, and so I can speak frankly with you guys. So she was descended from the son of Lot through an incestuous encounter with his daughter. Now that kind of puts a spin on the Moabites. That kind of says, okay, we know where the Moabites are, where they come from, and what their origin is. So you don't think that doesn't always play in to how they think about these people. Ruth's culture was either nomadic or farming. So she was a country girl because there were really no cities there. Ruth's religion was polytheistic. There were many gods and they practiced human sacrifice. But still, a lot of the characteristics of their major god, Chemosh, were similar to Yahweh's. But she could transfer some of her understanding over, not by any means all of it. So she's got some kind of background that she's picking up on. She voluntarily left everything to support Naomi. And the problem is, there is racial tension and prejudice in Bethlehem. They talk like Trump supporters, for sure. But Ruth, she's steadfast and loyal. She demonstrates loving kindness and mercy, which are really characteristics of God. You know, they keep talking about this hesed in Hebrew. Ruth has hesed, Boaz has hesed, most of all, God has hesed. But this is loving kindness. This is kindness towards God's people and God's kindness towards them. And she has mercy. Ruth takes the initiative and makes things happen. And you see this when she said to Naomi, "Don't press me to leave you or turn back from following you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and that's where I will be buried. May the Lord do thus and so to me and more as well, if even death parts me from you." Now that was a really solemn vow. "I am never, never going to leave you. I am going to be your support through whatever comes. It was amazing. Well, you know, this is the verse we use for the most major commitment that we make. Ruth, the Moabitess, the foreigner, the immigrant, she's the one who said this. So we learn that God's purposes and those who serve him reflect his holiness are not just limited to entitled Israelites or North Americans. Who knew? One scholar, a former professor, now a friend of mine, Bob Hubbard, said that the world would be a lot better off if there were more Ruths in it. But ultimately, the story about Ruth is going to be, it's kind of a romance, although I don't want you to be too misled by that. Our focus is on how Ruth meets her future husband, Boaz, and of course, there's going to be a baby. Got to be a baby. This is appropriate, huh? We find out about Boaz in verse 1 of chapter 2. He's Naomi's contact. She's like, Naomi's got a friend. She's got a patron. She's got a contact in Israel. It's this guy Boaz. And what's Boaz like? He's family. He's close family. He's rich. And he's prominent. The word in Hebrew suggests that he could be a war hero in this context. And there were a whole bunch of wars during the time of the judges. But here's the deal. He's really not a rock star. Don't read that into it. Don't read that, oh, he's cute. You know, he's not. In chapter 3, verse 10, he praises her for choosing him instead of running after younger women for love and money. So he doesn't think he's a great option. He really doesn't. He's like, I'm so surprised. I would have never thought I had a chance. You have so many better options that you could have gone for, I think maybe in the eyes of a young woman. And so he's not so young. Come to think of it, he must be pretty close to Naomi in age to be her contact in Bethlehem. You know, she's been gone 10 years, and he must have been an important person when she left. So he's not young. I know that's a little disappointing, and you might, I'd love to read this as being, you know, the boy meets girl instead of the middle-aged man meets newble young woman. But here it is. It is what it is. Here's the problem. Okay, Ruth doesn't know anything about Boaz, doesn't know anything about him being a contact or him being a resource or anything. She's poor and starving, and so is Naomi, and she's got a plan. So she quickly gets Naomi's permission to glean the fields to get food for both of them, hoping she can find favor with someone. What that means is says, I'm going to ask permission and hopefully get permission. Someone will maybe give me permission to let me glean, even though I'm a foreigner and an immigrant. Maybe they will. Now, gleaning is something that poor people, that is the foreigner, the orphan, and the widow, were supposed to be able to do in Israel. It's collecting leftover crops after a field has been harvested. And the right to glean was guaranteed by Mosaic law. For instance, Leviticus 19, 9 through 10, and Deuteronomy 24, 19 through 22. In fact, these passages command certain things to landowners. They say you can't harvest the edge of your field. You're supposed to leave the edges of your field unharvested. And if you drop anything to the ground while you're harvesting, you can't pick it up. Ooh, those are funny rules. You know, you can't even pick up some grain you drop, so you got to be pretty careful. But the thing is, you know, God says, that's for the poor people. That is for the poor people, and that's how we're going to provide for them. At least one of the ways. And he says, never strip the fields bare. That would be wrong. You leave some. And so he says, and he also says, you know what sheaves are? You know, in the harvest when they show the wheat all collected in a little pot, you know, a little, what is it, a little bundle, and it's really cute? That's a sheave. And he says, you know what? When you harvest, if you forget a sheave in the field, you don't even get to go back and get that. That's for the poor people. So, I mean, there's this real thinking about, this is a very conscious attempt to provide food. But at best, for the poor people, this is subsistence living, something like collecting cans and beer bottles. It's not going to get you that much, even with these rules. Well, you also can tell from the story that it is not a safe situation for Ruth. She is very vulnerable because she's an unprotected woman, and there are racial tensions against Moabites, clearly. And it keeps they keep calling her a Moabite, right? Sometimes they don't even say her name. Hey, that Moabite woman, you know? And so as potential verbal or physical abuse seems to be assumed. You notice that Boaz keeps saying to his workers, don't rebuke her, don't abuse her. And you get the feeling if he didn't stop it, it was going to happen just as a matter of course. And the men are going to do it. And actually, I think the language implies that she is at risk for rape. And Bob Hubbard said, oh, I don't think so. And I'm like, you know, after the Me Too movement, women know when you talk like this, this means someone could grab you and throw you into a corner and rape you, and you're always at risk, you're always watching, you're always careful. This is why women also need to interpret the Bible, because we know what this language means. We know. It's not just about someone talking mean to us. But Ruth was a person of courage, and she took the initiative and she took the risks. It so happened, as luck would have it, that she worked in a field that belonged to Boaz, the very person that Naomi had a contact with, but apparently hadn't gotten together with yet. And then Boaz shows up. More luck. And the way he talks is quite interesting. I think it reveals something about his character. There are normal ways of saying hello, and there are ways that are a little unusual. And he's a little unusual. He says, the Lord be with you, to his workers. And that really highlights, yeah, God really is with us. God's really with us, and he's thinking about it. Boaz is curious about Ruth, and he asks about her. I know a lot of times I've heard this story, like he goes, hey, who's the girl, you know, and like, hubba hubba. But I actually don't read it that way anymore, because I don't think he thinks he has a chance. I don't think that he's hitting on her in any part of this story, because when he, next chapter, we'll get to that next week, he's stunned when she actually asks him to marry her, and he's like, I couldn't even hope for that. What it is like you see great and deep admiration, but I don't think you see someone who's trying to hit on her in the things that he does. He finds out that she was a young woman who came back with Naomi. You know, in 119, it says the whole town was stirred up about what happened. We go, yeah, I know that little town, right? They're all, did you hear about Naomi? And did you hear what happened? And they're all talking. And he's heard about it too. And he's told that she's been waiting for permission to glean between the sheaves. Now, that's a little weird. And nobody knows quite what to do with it. Because you're supposed to glean at the edge of the field, and you're supposed to glean after the harvesters, you know, if they drop something and everything. What you're not supposed to do is go to where they're stacking up the sheaves and get all the loose stuff there. I mean, that's over the top, you know. Nobody lets you do that. But she's asked to do that. And is she naive? Or is she just really, really bold and said, I'm going to go for the gusto here? Because we are needy. We are so needy. Does it hurt to ask? So she's asked to do this. Boaz immediately gives her permission, and he gives her protection, as I've already mentioned, from his own workers and others. He's like, don't leave the field. Don't go out there. Don't go out there. It's dangerous. And these are all, don't even leave the group of women. You stay together with others. You stay safe. And and then the last thing he says, oh, yeah, you can share the workers' water. When you get thirsty, just have our water. And so this might not strike you as unusual, but this was incredibly unusual. You know, she's this poor foreigner, and he's actually inviting her in to actually be almost like an employee and work with him, and with all the protection and all the benefits. Ruth, just by this, is suitably overwhelmed and astonished by his kindness and generosity. She bows down to the ground and says, why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me when I am a foreigner? She understands her low status as an immigrant, and she's completely aware of the racial prejudice. And yeah, like I said, clearly most of the people in Bethlehem would have voted for Trump you know, if they had elections. She knew what people thought about her. But Boaz says, all that you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me. Yeah, that small town, right? He knows it all, knows everything. And I know how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people you didn't know before. And then it's really cool. May the Lord reward you for your deeds. May you have a full reward from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge. Boaz was very, very impressed. And he felt that as part of his responsibility, he needed to act like God, as God would act. He was trying to reciprocate her kindness towards Naomi. And he also said, he also had this sense of, this isn't even enough. This isn't even enough for what you've done and what you've sacrificed. I'm praying that God will pay you back in full. And that's kind of foreshadowing. You wonder how that's going to happen, right? And you're pretty sure that's going to be a major part of the story. She will be paid back in full. But Ruth, now, she's humble, and she doesn't take anything for granted. I almost feel like she's hopes that she's going to be able to live up to her reputation. If it were me, I'd be scared to death. You know, it says, oh, he thinks too highly of me. I'm going to ruin. She says, I hope I continue to have favor in your eyes. I hope I continue to uphold this amazing thing that you've said to me. She's so grateful for his reassurance and kindness and so conscious of her low status. Then what Boaz does next is really crazy. He invites her to have lunch with himself and his workers. And she gets to eat until she's full. When do you think was the last time that she got to eat till she was full? She had been starving. She had leftovers. The story makes a big deal about that. Next thing, and this is crazy too, he secretly orders his men. I see it as secret. I don't see that she heard him say it. Because it would dishonor her. He goes to his men and he gives them special commands. He says, let her gather among the sheaves. Let her do it. Even though that's crazy and a weird thing to ask, and most landowners, actually, I wonder if any landowners were really allowing gleaning. Just because the law said it, they weren't doing things during this time. They weren't holding years of jubilee. They weren't taking care of the poor like they were supposed to. I think there was always a chance people would say no. But Boaz not only says yes, but he says, yeah, go and glean, go grab some of that stuff from the sheaves. And he goes, and you guys, when she's not looking, pull some of those stalks out and throw them on the ground. So she gets to have more. So he's like really, really supplying her needs, but in a way that is sensitive and honors her. It's pretty cool. So Ruth gleaned all day. I mean, she's a hard, hard worker. And then she threshed the grain. You know what threshing is, right? Because you got the grain on the sheaves, and then you knock the grain off the sheaves and throw the chaff in the air, and then it blows away and the seeds come down. And after, so she gleans all day, threshes into the night, and when it's done, she's got an ephah. That's impressive, right? No, what is that? That's like 30 pounds of grain. She had 30 pounds of grain at the end of the day. And I'm trying to say, how does she get it home? And then I just remembered, I just saw some pictures from Africa about women carrying hundreds of pounds of sticks on their back like this. Yeah, she put that 30 pounds in her back, and she took it home. But this 30 pounds, that's the equivalent of half a month's wage for a field worker. Half a month's wage. You don't get that from gleaning. So. Really, I think that the climax is here, though you might have said it was a little earlier in the story. She brings this huge bag home to Naomi. And that's really what the story is about. This woman who has been destitute and hopeless and left without anything has her daughter-in-law, who would almost seem like she's a burden, right? Show up at the house at the end of the day and say, I hope you got something. She's got 30 pounds of grain and leftovers. And leftovers, don't forget the leftovers. So she's not only has the grain, but she pulls out cooked food that's all cooked. Hey, that's like going out for a restaurant meal after the end of a hard day. And Naomi can put two and two together. She knows for a fact that someone has helped Ruth out. So she's like, who is it? I'm going to find out. And she asked where Ruth had gleaned and blesses the man who took notice of her. And so when Ruth told her it was in Boaz's field and she'd been working with Boaz, she was over the moon. She was thrilled. Naomi's much happier about it than Ruth is. Because I'm not sure Ruth totally knows what's going on here. I think she doesn't know the culture. You know how it is when you don't know the culture and you don't know how to read signals. You know how that is. It was that way in Japan for you. What is this really? I don't know. I'll wait till someone explains it to me. But meanwhile, I'll just keep on keeping on. And Naomi says, blessed be he by the Lord whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. She says, that man's a relative. He's our nearest kin. So after feeling abandoned and depressed, Naomi has this deep experience of God's love and care through both Ruth and Boaz. She starts to have a hope. Something is happening. God is doing something in all these coincidences. She's the one who recognizes it. She's the one who knows. And she's going to start to work with him. So Ruth tells Naomi all about how Boaz protected her. And Naomi said, yep, stay in that field. Stick close to the women or else you might get, someone's going to rape you if you don't do that. And so, Ruth's like, fine, okay. So she worked Boaz's field for 2 months. But we know that now Naomi is concocting a plan. But when Naomi said that Boaz is our nearest kin, she was referring to something they call the role of the kinsman redeemer. Property that was lost because of a debt could be recovered by paying a fee. Her husband had had property in Israel because everyone got inherited property, but they had lost it. But it was never totally lost. Everyone knew that that land belonged to him. And so Boaz would be one of the people that would have the right to redeem that land for them. Major importance. That means that you're not locked in poverty forever. So he has that role. Furthermore, there was a Levirate law in Deuteronomy 25 that says if a married man dies without a child, the widow's brother-in-law is obligated to marry her and give her a baby. Again, the baby thing, right? She's got to have a baby, people. You make it happen. And so that allows his dead brother's name to continue. And this is like a huge thing. And say, it's not even direct blood or descent. It's that I have a people who remember that I lived and I exist. And I'm part of their story. And they're going to continue to tell that. And that is the continued possession of the land and the continued remembrance of the name. This is like really, really vital to your identity and your culture. So what happens isn't going to be precisely like that. I mean, Boaz, for instance, isn't her brother-in-law, but it seems like he's assuming this is going to extend here. Whoever takes this land's got to take Ruth. She's going to go with it. And he seems to recognize this responsibility. At least eventually he does. And I'm sure he's got his eye on her. But for now, from Ruth's perspective, her initiative and bravery has gotten her food. It's gotten her a friend, a patron, and this wonderful older man who is protecting her. And she's got a new status among the workers because of the way he's treating her. He's not treating her like she's some kind of random poor alien. He's treating her like she belongs to his house, which in a way, I think he is seeing her as belonging to his house. As the Passover Seder says, if the Lord had stopped here in the story, it would have been enough. But there are some open possibilities that we're going to move forward with. But as far as like how we take this story forward from here, I've just got two general observations that I want to say. The first thing is that the Bible's view of women and their roles is far different than a lot of people say it is. It is not a sexist and patriarchal worldview. What's happening here and what's happened in the line of Jesus, that's nothing what like the Bible that people say the Bible says about women's roles. These women are all coloring outside the lines and taking initiative that well-behaved women don't necessarily do. So that's one thing. And second, as far as the story of your life, keep this idea that God's involved in your life, always in mind, and interpret your life with the eyes of faith. And just remember, it ain't over till it's over. At all points. But I'm going to go off a little bit of a different track with my main points. I just wanted to make those points as big points. There are three types of people that you're supposed to be identifying with in this story. And God is in with each one of them in the everyday affairs of their lives. So Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz are very, very interesting people that have displayed some very important characteristics. Naomi is a person who's lost everything. Yes, she has situational depression. Yes, she's bitter. And you notice the story never judges her, not once. But she's on the watchtower, and she's the one who detects God's presence and care and all these coincidences. She's the one who sees what's going on, and she's the one who comes up with a plan. Like, there's an old book that talks about how we're supposed to see where God is working and then join him. That's Naomi. That is Naomi. She sees where God is working, and then she goes, I'm going to work with him. We're going to make this happen. And then Ruth has nothing but gives up everything. She manifests the character of God himself in her relationship to Naomi. Loving kindness, loyalty, steadfastness, resourcefulness. She's brave, she's bold, she'll take risks. She reminds me of 1 Timothy 2, 9 and 10. I'm not sure if she's an attractive woman or not. I go back and forth on it, but I'll tell you this. She has made herself attractive with good works, as is proper for women who profess a reverence to God. She is enormously attractive as a person, not because of what she looks like, but because of what of her character and because of what she has done. So she really is almost the Christ type and the God type in this story, right? In another way, Boaz is, though. Boaz has resources, and he uses them to practice hospitality and deep generosity towards the marginalized, towards the poor and the immigrant. And he exceeds the requirement of the law by far. He's a great judge of character, and he has a really fine-tuned sense of reciprocity and justice. So he's kind of stands for social justice in this whole story. And, you know, at this point, that's where he is, right? Not some Romeo, but a person who is incredibly just and incredibly interested in seeing, you know, reciprocity in people who serve each other and who serve God. So these things are part of the pedigree of King David and ultimately Jesus. This is defining who and what they are. Very cool, right? Because the Bible says this defines who their descendants are. Now you know. These are the basic elements that we'll see in a redemption that's played out in the whole story, because the story is about redemption. And each person in their own way, in their own special way, in their own gifted way, is working with God to accomplish his purposes. I could call them vision, godly love, and provision, I guess, among other things. And so I think they all can serve as models to us. I mean, we can't all be as good at each of these characteristics as each of these characters are, but we can emulate them. We can imitate them. That's what we're always called to do, and that's what stories are about. You know, saying, I like that person. I'd like to be like that person. So if you want to be like Naomi, you're going to say, where is God in my everyday affairs? Where is God in my everyday affairs? And this is I've said this here before, I'm sure many times, that you ask God, ask where God is in your story. Where is God in this? And Naomi was a master. Have you had any God sightings lately? Oh, really take some time and think about that. Think about your life with the eyes of faith and where God has been. Talk about it with one another. The second thing is, how can you join God actively to accomplish his purposes in your own life like Ruth? Where are places you can take the initiative and move forward? That is, it's not just about seeing God, but it's about joining God in his work, recognizing like this, here's a place that I'm supposed to move forward. I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to be bold. I'm going to take the initiative. And, you know, that's like a calling, right? Once you see what's going on, that almost is like a calling on your life to work with God on it. That's what, if you want to know if I'm called, that's what it is. You notice what God is doing. Everybody notices what God is doing in their own unique way. And then you say, well, this would be a good idea. Well, that's your calling. Simple. And then where do you have an opportunity to offer hospitality and generosity like Boaz? Pay it forward, pay it back. Whatever. This is a great model for what King David was, a person after God's own heart. Ultimately, a great model. It's what we call typology for Christ himself. This is the kind of identity that Christ had. And so may we be like Christ today. You know, there's things, imitate Christ, imitate Paul. There's these little stories about God being in the details of everyday life that make it much more attainable in some way. That God is working in these normal little things, and we can accomplish big things in these normal little things. Let's pray. Lord, I pray that this story would live in our hearts. I think that that's the biggest thing, is to read this story and have a feel for it. To read the story and live in it and be able to walk around in it a little bit and to have this sense of what's going on, to be drawn into it, to be drawn into these lives and somehow drawn into these patterns so that they start playing out in our own lives. I pray that you will help us to have vision, godly love, and be a resource for provision. I pray that you would be showing us those little things, not the big things, not the miracles, not the big gesture, but the everyday things, the everyday opportunities, and the everyday sightings of you would be characteristic of us, so that we really, really would be walking on your path throughout all of the episodes of our life, the hard places, the times where we have situational depression, and we all do. We all will have times where we experience loss and grief in our relationships with each other, in our commitment through those relationships. I pray give us a vision to act as your people. In your son's name, amen.